أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، بعث الأنبياء والمرسلين، والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد، وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين، روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين إلى قيام يوم الدين. For the hastening and the return of our Imam, let's recite the salawat. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. We were discussing the book of Al-Kafi. In it, as Sheikh Al-Kulayni has divided the book, that the entirety of it, the collection of Al-Kafi, into three major divisions, one being Usul, another being Furu', and lastly being Rawda. In the Furu', which is what we've covered, he then divides these into books. He calls them Kitab al-Salah, Kitab al-Sawm, for instance, Kitab al-Zakah. We started discussing a hadith last week from Kitab al-Jihad, and we said that it's important that we learn of these hadith, understand them. If somebody quotes something from hadith that they use to attack Islam, if we have already seen it and we realize that's not the accurate citation, for instance, or sometimes the explanation is not there, it's taken out of context. And more importantly, of course, these are ahadith that are relevant to us. It's important that we studied them. Last week we finished with a hadith. I don't want to read it. Those who've been following, they remember we mentioned that at the end of hadith number 3 of this, the chapter of Fadlul Jihad, the first chapter of Kitabul Jihad, is Fadlul Jihad, Babu Fadlul Jihad. And hadith number 3 quoted the Holy Prophet. The last part of it said that the Prophet was told by Jibra'il, Ya Muhammad, man ghaza min ummatika fi sabilillah, fa asabahu qatratun min as-sama' aw suda'un kataballahu azza wa jalla lahu shahada. We said qatratun min as-sama'. The only meaning that comes to our mind is qatra means a drop. A drop hits you from the sky. The only drop that can always be understood in every context, that seems to be a generic statement. It's not limited. It's not speaking of a particular fight or battle or jihad. It's general. It's broad, and therefore it must have its broad meaning. The only broad meaning of qatra from the sky would be rain. And we said, well, think about it more. I thought about it, and it became more clear that that is the meaning. It's we did sort of lean towards this meaning last week, but I said I will think about it further, and I will explain. So that's what we're explaining right now. It's trying to say Jibra'il was told by Allah to tell the Prophet so that we hear, he tells us, that jihad is so valuable. If a person goes towards jihad fi sabilillah, and this particular case, not just any jihad, ghaza. We mentioned some of these ahadith are about jihad. Jihad is more broad, more general, meaning that any type of struggling and striving in the way of Allah would be referred to as jihad. Of course, it's striving and struggling, so it's against obstacles created by shayateen, by abalis, by enemies of Islam. So it has to do with a struggle against wrong and against evil and against evil doers, against devils, and so on and so forth. But it's not necessarily a ghazwa. A ghazwa is a military conflict, which is otherwise in the Quran referred to, at least in most cases, as qital. Qital is the word referring to military conflict, where the two parties engage in battle. They each have their respective warfare and they fight each other. Some get killed on each side and then there's a winner. That's called qital. Or here we have ghaza. Ghazwa is that type of warfare, meaning a military warfare. The hadith is encouraging. We explain all of that. Anyone who engages in this form of jihad, part of jihad, it comes to a ghazwa. When does that happen? That's a different topic. It doesn't address the point of when is it, when does it happen where there is a ghazwa that one needs to participate in or can participate in. It simply says when that happens, when there is an opportunity, a taklif, a responsibility, there is a need for people to go and fight. The one who chooses to go to fight, but they go fi sabilillah, in the way of Allah. Their intention, their motivation is for Allah, not for other purposes. This is so valuable, just going for that ghazwa, that even if nothing happens except for just a drop of rain, that's the slightest thing. The emphasis here is this. The slightest discomfort that could happen. You get wet. Even just one drop, you feel that one drop hitting you. You feel discomfortable, uncomfortable with that. Or the next one, a headache. And it doesn't have to be a horrific headache. Just a little pain in the head. Even that much. كتب الله عز وجل شهادة. Allah writes a shahada, this person is a martyr. Even though they haven't even been hurt, injured, not even a scratch. It's a drop of rain from the sky. It's not even from, but you went with this intention, that's how valuable it is. The Prophet said in it earlier. I don't want to reread it, so I just wanted to complete that discussion, and that it does mean a drop of rain from the sky. The next hadith is a longer hadith. I'm going to try to read and try to interpret as best I can. I want to also reiterate that I'm not an Arab and I've studied a lot the Arabic language, classical especially. I don't speak Arabic, but I've studied a lot classical Arabic, the Arabic in hadith and in the Quran. I don't consider myself completely or complete in that, and that everything I understand 100% and there's no errors, especially when it gets to certain language forms, certain contexts that are a little more difficult. This I find to be one of those that, at least for me, is a little more difficult. But I'm going to try my best. Let's see what we can understand. We ask Allah, if Allah wants to grant understanding, He will. And the doors, the locks on the doors of understanding, He will unlock. And we will be able to get to that by the rights of the Ahlul Bayt. So this is hadith number 4. Muhammad ibn Yahya, an Ahmad ibn Muhammad ibn Isa, an al-Hasan ibn Mahbub, عن بعض أصحابه قال كتب أبو جعفر عليه السلام. So the chain up to Al-Hasan ibn Mahbub is a very good chain of transmission, a good isnad or good sanad, depending on which word in Qum at least. Iranian scholars use the word sanad, and there is room for that. It does make sense for that word to be used, but many times the other word that is used is isnad. Either way, there are some minor differences between the words, but they're referring in both terminology-wise at least, not literally terminology-wise, they're used to refer to the same thing. Anyhow, so the sanad or the isnad is perfect, is great. Muhammad ibn Yahya, the teacher of Sheikh Khulaini, we've discussed it many times. Ahmad ibn Muhammad ibn Isa, this is al-Ash'ari al-Qummi, his origins are Yemeni. From the Ash'aris of Kufa. Of course, what we mean by Yemeni is, I don't know how many generations, because during the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, before him becoming the Khalifa, Yemenis were some of the major or the main known tribes of Kufa. Some of the main ones, at least, were Yemeni tribes. So when exactly did they relocate from Yemen, from whatever city in Yemen, to Kufa, but they were known as the Yemenis. So Al-Ash'ari, he's from that tribe, and they relocated his father, perhaps maybe his grandfather, but I think it's his father that relocated to Qum. And he, Ahmad ibn Muhammad ibn Isa, is one of the very well-known scholars, very strict scholars of hadith. And it's interesting, he's narrating from Al-Hasan ibn Mahbub. There was a period, they say, this is Rijal, it's, some find it interesting, but besides it being interesting, it's valuable information that helps us. There was a time where Ahmad ibn Muhammad ibn Isa would not narrate from Al-Hasan ibn Mahbub that we have in this chain of transmission. And the reason was Al-Hasan ibn Mahbub narrates from Abu Hamza al-Thumali. Abu Hamza al-Thumali is mainly the companion of Imam Zain al-Abidin, salamullah alayhi. And then to a certain extent, a companion of Imam al-Baqir, salawatullah wa salamu alayhi. And Imam al-Baqir's Shahada is 114 of the Hijri calendar. And if you do the math, for him to have been able to have seen Abu Hamza, it's pretty far-fetched. Normally, people at Al-Hasan ibn Mahbub's age would not be able to narrate from Abu Hamza al-Thumali. He would be too far back from them. The thing, however, was that Al-Hasan ibn Mahbub, I think we've mentioned this before, he started writing hadith as a child. His dad taught him or had him learn to read and write, and to encourage him to get involved with hadith, he would pay him a coin. I'm not sure if it was gold or silver, dirham or dinar, but a whole coin for each hadith he would write. So he was involved in writing hadith and collecting hadith from scholars of hadith as a child, and that's the reason why. But initially, Ahmad ibn Muhammad ibn Isa, as we said, he's a very strict scholar of hadith. His strictness has a lot of different stories. It was hard for him to accept that, but eventually he came through. And the problem was, if he hadn't actually seen Abu Hamza al-Thumali, and he was saying that he's narrating from him directly, then that would be a lie. And if he's a liar, then you can't trust him. That's why for a period he wasn't narrating from him. But, and that wasn't accusing him, of course, inshallah, I don't know, but inshallah it wasn't that. Because there are some cases that, unfortunately, he has accused people of things. And because that's historically documented and it was open, and it's okay for us to say, he has accused some very great scholars of things that were not correct. But in this case, it's not clear to me that he accused him of that, but he wasn't sure. And so he wasn't sure, therefore, if Al-Hasan ibn Mahbub is a reliable person. He doesn't have to be sure that he's not, in his strict view of narrators of hadith. He needs to be sure that he is a reliable person. And so once that got cleared up and that he is not lying, so he started narrating hadith from him. The problem for those who have a similar strictness in the recent years is that Al-Hasan ibn Mahbub says, عن بعض أصحابنا, or عن بعض أصحابه, excuse me, one of his companions. Who is this companion? He is not named. And so according to people like Sayyid Khoui or similar views, there are some scholars that have similar to Sayyid Khoui views and their interpretation of what a hadith, a reliable hadith is, they would say, well, we don't know who this person is, and therefore we cannot consider him reliable, and if we don't know him to be reliable, then we can't trust that hadith. According to them, this would be, the title used would be Mursal, and this would be a Mursal hadith. We have explained more than once that that's not our view. In fact, that doesn't seem to be the common view amongst Shia scholars over the course of time. There have been some ups and downs, some extremes both ways. The Akhbari, one extreme, the strictness of people like Ahmad ibn Muhammad ibn Isa, in ways, of course, obviously he's narrating this hadith, so that he doesn't have this form of strictness that these people have. But there is a certain rigidness and strictness with hadith that they even make comments as such that, you know, most of our hadith are not reliable. No, those are incorrect views that they have because of their foundations in the Rijal, which are not correct. They're not founded in our sources, which we have tried to explain briefly. They come to such views. Anyhow, قال, we consider this a reliable hadith. قال كتب أبو جعفر, that person that Al-Hasan ibn Mahbub is narrating from, said that Abu Ja'far wrote a letter في رسالة إلى بعض خلفاء بني أمية. This needs a pause right here. Okay, we don't really hear too much of this. According to this account, Abu Ja'far, Imam al-Baqir, salam Allah alayh, wrote في رسالة, رسالة is something that you send, a letter, إلى بعض خلفاء بني أمية. Some of the خلفاء of بني أمية. During the time of Imam al-Baqir, there wasn't only one Khalifa. There were periods in each of these dynasties, the Umayyads or the Abbasids, where quickly a few khulafa changed. And then there was, I think, the main one at the time of Imam al-Baqir was a Hisham or Husham ibn Abdul Malik. But before him, there were a few others. It was Husham that La'natullah alayh has our Imam's blood on his hands. But before him, there were other khulafa. Which one? It doesn't say here. It says Imam al-Baqir wrote a letter to some of the khulafa. And what did he do? وَمِن ذَلِكْ مَا ضَيَّعَ الْجِهَادِ. It starts with this. This part, portion of the letter. From the get-go, we see this is a letter that is not a love letter or a letter written to see how they were doing and so on. It's a harsh letter written to condemn what the Khalifa was doing and to take his steps or his stances, do what he can, he should, in order to correct, although he knows that they won't listen, but his job, his taklif, as the Imam, is to notify, to remind, to criticize when criticism is needed. So this is one fact that we learn here. Imam al-Baqir, at least one letter we have to some of the khulafa, one of the khulafa of Bani Umayyah, he wrote. Part of the criticism has to do with, it seems like jihad. Sheikh al-Kulayni has put this in the chapter of Fadlul Jihad. There are some words in here that are relevant to the chapter. However, I find it to contain a lot more valuable information. I don't know if Sheikh al-Kulayni has mentioned this hadith in other chapters of his book as well or not, because when you put it and somebody's searching for a hadith, they just look at the chapter Fadlul Jihad and they think, okay, this is where I'll find hadith related to how valuable jihad is. But a historic, a hadith of that's related to a historic occurrence, event, and has a context and discusses much more than just Fadlul Jihad, this is why there needs to be reading of hadith. This is why scholars and people, hadith reading is not limited to scholars. They just pick up hadith books and just read chapters that they don't think might contain something that's relevant to them. Well, these chapters were, these are how scholars have organized, and the chapter title is given by the scholar. It's his understanding. You might find material in that hadith that may actually convince you that the hadith is not even related to the chapter title. It proves the opposite sometimes. Anyhow, so let's read. What is it? مِنْ ذَلِكْ مَا ضَيَّعَ الْجِهَادِ. Punctuation is relatively recent. Not relatively, it is very recent, I believe. I don't know how much of that currently there is in Arabic. There is some, I don't know how much. But at the time of the compilation of hadith and writing of hadith, they only wrote the consonants, not even the vowels of words. That's not something that generally is done in Arabic. People have to memorize the vowels of each word, and they need to know how that works. But otherwise, the vowels are not written. It's only the consonants that are written. Punctuation, there is none. And so that makes it very difficult at times when there's lengthy writings to make out sentences and so on and so forth. So that's part of what makes this difficult, especially since this is part of a letter. Now, what was before it, we don't know. If that was there, might have helped. Anyhow, مَا ضَيَّعَ الْجِهَادِ. One possibility, تَضْيِع means to, for want of a better word, destruction. Perhaps another word could be destruction is the only word that comes to mind. I'm not sure if that's the best equivalent, but right now that's the only one that comes to my mind. Destruction and to destroy something. مَا ضَيَّعَ الْجِهَادِ means how destructed or destroyed or ruined, maybe that's another word, how ruined jihad is. Okay, this is a statement. He's complaining about the status quo. How jihad has been ruined. Okay, so this part of the letter is attacking the position of the khalifa. The khalifa is the ruler of the Muslimin. Jihad is something that is under the guidance of the ruler of the Muslimin. Whether they do it right or wrong is a different thing, and that's what the point here is, that they're doing it wrong, and they've ruined it, what the idea of jihad is. So, since the Khalifa is involved with it, the Imam is attacking, is criticizing what is happening with regards to jihad. مَا ضَيَّعَ الْجِهَادِ. Which jihad? What is jihad? Now, when you want to say it's been ruined, now if this is something that is not very important, well, who cares? But the Imam wants to emphasize, look, this is what has been ruined, this is what has been neglected, has been destroyed, it's in ruins. Which jihad? الَّذِي فَضَّلَهُ اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلَ عَلَى الْأَعْمَالِ. The jihad that God valued it above other deeds. وَفَضَّلَ عَامِلَهُ عَلَى الْعُمَّالِ. And he preferred and valued the عامل, the one who conducts that, the one who is involved with jihad, عَلَى الْعُمَّالِ, over others, over those who conduct other deeds, are involved with other deeds. What type of preference and valuing over? تَفْضِيلًا فِي الدَّرَجَاتِ وَالْمَغْفِرَةِ وَالرَّحْمَةِ. This perhaps is referring to the verse of the Holy Quran, مَا يَسْتَوِي الْقَاعِدُونَ غَيْرُ أُولِي الضَّرَرِ وَالْمُجَاهِدُونَ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. Or لَا يَسْتَوِي الْقَاعِدِينَ or قَاعِدُونَ, I can't remember right what the exact wording, if it's mansub or is it, if it's marfu', al-qa'idin or al-qa'idun. Either way, it's in Surah An-Nisa, you can search it and find it. The verse says that those who sit and don't get involved with jihad and those who do get involved with jihad of the mu'mineen are not the same. فَضَّلَ اللَّهُ الْمُجَاهِدِينَ عَلَى الْقَاعِدِينَ دَرَجَةً. God has preferred the mujahidun, those who are involved with jihad, as the Imam words it here, amilul jihad, the one who is involved, who performs jihad, God says we've preferred them. And then it says, wa kullan wa'adallahu al-husna, in each, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given promise of good to them. And then there's mention of, if I remember correctly, so daraja we already mentioned, فَضَّلَ اللَّهُ مُجَاهِدِينَ الْمُجَاهِدِينَ عَلَى الْقَاعِدِينَ دَرَجَةً. It says darajat here. Why that's singular, this is plural for another time, but there's no conflict between the two. Maghfira is another one that's mentioned in the verse, not in this particular passage I read, but it's mentioned, if I remember correctly, further down or in the next verse. And rahmah is also mentioned there as well. So the Imam says this, God has preferred those who are involved with jihad. Jihad is so valuable that those who perform it have been valued greater in terms of their rank, in terms of the maghfirah they received, in terms of the rahmah or the blessings that they receive. And then the Imam explains, لِأَنَّهُ ظَهَرَ بِهِ الدِّينَ. Because the deen, the religion, becomes apparent. I explained this yesterday, and excuse me, last session. We explained this, and we didn't use this wording here, but we said it is going to be mentioned, these ideas are going to be mentioned, why the Prophet has said the deen or the swords are what need to be, I don't remember the exact wording, but there was emphasis about the sword and how believers need to have the sword and all the good. Al-khayru kulluhu fi safe, that wording I do remember. We explain, the reason is this, لَأَنَّهُ ظَهَرَ بِهِ الدِّينَ. It's not about killing people and loving to see bloodshed or... No, that's... Those are the ones that the deen doesn't want them to have power. If the mu'mineen and mu'minat, if the leaders of the religion don't take the sword and use it, when oppressors are using it against people, then that's going to lead to bloodshed and people coming to power, being involved, being in charge, that will lead to that. And that's the opposite of deen. Deen is what is going to bring prosperity to all. Materially, spiritually, psychologically, family-wise, socially, economically, everything, from all aspects. That's why, because deen can only, the zuhur of it, it becoming apparent on the land, it being something that is seen everywhere, that's the zuhur of the deen, right? This zuhur happens with jihad, that's why jihad, all aspects of deen, you pray, that's not going to cause zuhur of the deen. What's going to cause zuhur of the deen? Jihad is. It's because of jihad that prayer finds zuhur, becomes apparent. It's because of that that Sawm becomes apparent. It's because of that that Hajj becomes apparent. Otherwise, there will be no Hajj. لَأَنَّهُ ظَهَرَ بِهِ الدِّينَ وَبِهِ يُدْفَعُ عَنِ الدِّينَ. And with it, religion is defended. With it, religion is defended. Deen that has all these values and everything good in religion is in religion. The entirety of it needs defense. How do you defend it? Jihad. وَبِهِ اشْتَرَى اللَّهُ مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ أَنفُسَهُمْ وَأَمْوَالَهُمْ بِالْجَنَّةِ بَيْعًا مُفْلِحًا مُنْجِحًا. And with it, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala buys from the believers, from the mu'mineen, anfusahum, their selves, wa amwalahum, their belongings, bil jannah, in return for paradise, bay'an, a trade that is muflihan, that causes prosperity, munjihan, causes najah, and success. A very rewarding, successful, prosperous trade. You give yourself, you give your belongings, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala buys you, yourself and your belongings in return for what? Jannah. Jannah is like a code. Just look at everything that is there regarding Jannah. And it's not just a garden. We are already living in nice weather, nice climate, nice environment in terms of vegetation and so on and so forth. No, that's a code. It refers to everything that's there. Now, up to this point in the letter, the Imam mentioned that he's complaining how ruined is jihad. And then he explained the greatness of jihad with these words. Then from this point onwards, let's see what the Imam is trying to say. I'll read it, but just I put that pause. There isn't punctuation, but let's see what this from this point onwards is going to be. It's just a continuous writing. We have to make out what is what we can understand of this. اشترط عليهم فيه حفظ الحدود. So let me put it out before I wanted to read a little bit and translate, but I'll put this out. You think about it yourself. Those were the values and the greatness of jihad. Okay. And he said jihad is ruined. This act is ruined. How is it ruined? How is it that it's ruined? One little historic point that needs to be mentioned. If you look at the history of the Umayyad dynasty, if we understand the concept of jihad to be military conflict with disbelievers, or rather, I should reword that, with non-believers, with anyone that goes against the quote-unquote Islamic state, the Islamic government, well, that needs a little bit of explanation. If that's how jihad is interpreted, if that is what is understood as jihad, then when you look at history, actually the Umayyads did that. The Umayyads were involved with that. How so? There were expansions. The Muslim Empire grew during the time of the Umayyads. So they fought the non-believers and they added to the territory of the Muslimin. The Islamic Empire grew all the way to Spain during the Umayyad Empire. They took and conquered all of North Africa, all the way to Morocco of today, what is currently called Morocco. And they went north, they crossed Jabal al-Tariq, as it is called in Arabic, Jabal Tar, if I pronounce that right. That strait, there's a strait there, the closest passageway that you can cross from Africa into Europe. They crossed that, they fought the Spanish. At that time, they weren't really equipped, they weren't they didn't have what they had during the Spanish Empire, and they fell in Cordoba, or in Arabic, Qurtub was one of the major cities. We have scholars from Qurtub, which is a city, Cordoba in Spain. You'll find it on the map. Well, this happened during the Umayyad dynasty. Now, I'm not sure the time-wise if this is during the time of Imam al-Baqir, salamullah alayhi, or not. But the point is that whether all of that expansion had already occurred, because Imam al-Baqir is towards the end of not exactly the end. His martyrdom is during Hisham ibn Abdul Malik's time. He's one of the major rulers of the Marwani Umayyad rulers, because the Umayyad Khulafa, there is a period of Muawiyah and his children, then Marwan's children, Banu Marwan, the Marwani Umayyad rulers. One of the major ones was Hisham ibn Abdul Malik. And after Hisham, and after Imam al-Baqir, salamullah alayhi, is Imam al-Sadiq. Imam al-Sadiq is the transition period where the dynasty, the Umayyad dynasty, falls and the Abbasid dynasty is established. So by the time of 138, if I remember correctly, 138 after the Hijrah, by that time, the Abbasid dynasty has been established. So between 114 and 138 is the fall of the Umayyads and the establishment of the Abbasid dynasty. So I think it has perhaps already occurred, or it's around that time that this happens. Imam al-Baqir salamullah alayhi is seeing that. So according to those, according to the understanding that jihad means that, well, they did that. According to the understanding that jihad means, if there's any rebellion against the Islamic government, that that needs to be suppressed, that needs to be taken care of, they need to fight, they're called bughat. They rebel against the government, they need to be dealt with. Well, they did that as well. In fact, Yazid's excuse to attack the haram of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn, salamullah wa salawatuhu alayh, was that this is a rebellion against the state, against the Islamic state. If that is what jihad is, well, they were actually involved in it. That's the problem, though. See, the tadhyi', the ruining of jihad, is misusing it, calling something that is the opposite of jihad as jihad. My understanding is, Imam al-Baqir is trying to explain this. Jihad has been ruined. Not that there isn't a military, not that the territories aren't widening or expanding, not that anyone who goes against the Islamic State is not being dealt with, but what is the purpose of all, what's the direction of all of that? Why is it if the state is being defended? Is this a state that should be defended? The Islamic State, of course, should be defended. But the Islamic State, with these laws, with what the rulers are doing, as they are behaving, calling it an Islamic State? No, that's not an Islamic State. The ones who had uprisings against the rulers during, of course, Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi's time, it is that Zayd al-Shahid has his rebellion against the Umayyad rulers. That's sort of the, that triggers the ripple effects of that, or the domino effects of the rise of Zayd al-Shahid, is what causes the downfall of the Umayyads. That's, of course, something closer to the downfall. Otherwise, what tipped it over was Karbala, Imam al-Husayn. But there's a longer wait after that. One of the, in terms of rebellions, it's the rebellion of Zayd al-Shahid. The rebellion of Zayd al-Shahid, fighting against him, isn't jihad, but that's what the government is saying. That's jihad. It's like what the Saudi government is doing, saying we are Khalifa of Rasulullah. That's what they say. It's funny, it's hilarious, it's hard for me to even say that, but that's what they say. We're the Khalifa of Rasulullah. The Khalifa of Rasulullah that protects kuffar, that prostrates to kuffar, that brings kuffar to spread kufr in Mecca and Medina. They work for the kuffar, for the Zionists, for the Americans, and they call themselves Khalifa of Rasulullah. And then when the Muslimin in Arabia rise to speak against that, say, oh, it's jihad, kill that person. That person is a kafir, a baghi, a rebel, is a kafir, and kill him. He's blood is not worth anything. This is jihad. This is jihad. Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi, Imam al-Baqir, excuse me, Abu Ja'far al-Baqir salamullah alayhi, is explaining this idea and critiquing how jihad is being used. Look, اشترط عليهم فيه حفظ الحدود. In jihad, what the mujahideen are expected to do is uphold Islamic guidelines. The objective of jihad is upholding Islamic guidelines, and the way you engage in jihad is, there are hudud, there are guidelines, there are red lines. There's certain things you're not supposed to do. Certain tactics you're not supposed to use. Certain weapons you're not supposed to use. Those are red lines. Others use them. That's their problem. We could be defeated. That's, Allah is with us. If we do what He says, we will not be defeated. But even if we are defeated, we're still not going to do that. Red line, hudud. Ishtarata alayhim, God has conditioned on them and restricted them to hifz al hudud, to preserve the hudud. وأول ذلك, the first condition, the first had in regards to jihad. Now we said the purpose of it is that we worded it in a different way. Let's go with the flow of the imam, what he's saying. You need to do hifz of hudud in jihad. You need to hold the guidelines of jihad. The first guideline of it is الدعاء إلى طاعة الله. The purpose of jihad. The purpose of jihad is to call people towards the obedience of God. من طاعة العباد. The purpose of it is to call, الدعاء, calling people to obey God, من طاعة العباد, instead of obeying people who are God's slaves, servants, العباد. وإلى عبادة الله من عبادة العباد. To call people towards worshipping God instead of worshipping Trump or worshipping Biden or worshipping the Zionists, worshipping whatever ruled, the Queen of England. Instead of worshipping the Ibad, worship Allah. وَإِلَىٰ وَلَايَةِ اللَّهِ مِنْ وَلَايَةِ الْعِبَادِ. It's calling people towards walaya of Allah instead of the walaya of people who are slaves of God. Let me pause here. Explain this a bit. They're using jihad, fighting, qital, ghazw, whatever you want to call it. It's being used at that time and today in the name of jihad. I'll give you examples. The imam is saying that it should be to call people towards Allah, not towards people. It's being used to call towards people. The Umayyad Khalifa is dealing with Zayd al-Shahid. Why? Because he wants people to obey him. He doesn't care what God says. He says, I am God's representative. Whatever I say is what God says. In other words, I'm God. It's just that because they're in an Islamic context, they couldn't openly say what Fir'aun said. When you say I'm Khalifatullah, whatever I say is from God, you actually mean that, well, nobody can have direct contact with God, right? The Quran is available. You're going against God's word. You're going against the Quran. And what are you saying? Like, oh, I'm God's representative. So you're saying I'm receiving something other than that. Baloney, you're not receiving anything. You're just claiming that I am God. I want people to worship me, to follow me. That's really what it is. Jihad that is supposed to be calling towards ibadah of Allah and not people is being used in that way. If the Prophet did jihad and he brought people in the context, that's something that will be our next discussion if we get time in this session. These are very important discussions and they need to be understood correctly. When the Prophet went to Masjid Dhirar, as the Quran Surah At-Tawbah mentions that God says, this is not a masjid, this is not a place of worship. The Munafiqeen created they called it a mosque, but it was a gathering place to plot against the Muslimin. There were Munafiqeen that God has called them Munafiqeen, and some of them people knew that they were Munafiqeen. But as long as it was just ridiculousness in their words and it didn't really harm the Muslims, nothing was done. But when they created that, and then they started establishing ties with the enemies of the Muslimin, the Kuffar on the outside that had issues, the Romans, they started communicating, working, collaborating with the Romans to destroy the Muslimin. When they started doing that, God said, that's not a house of worship, destroy that house. The Prophet went and fought them. That's jihad against the Bughat. Okay. Well, looks like, well, they don't want to follow the Prophet. They want to follow someone else. The Prophet is shutting them down and telling them that you need to follow me. That may be how it's seen. Or in the current context, if in the Islamic government that is possible during the Ghaiba, which is Wilayatul Faqih, a Faqih as government, people go against, they plot against, they establish ties with the Americans, with the Israelis, with the British, with the French, with the whatever, and they start plotting against the Waliul Faqih, the leadership. They start printing periodicals, they bring people out, they arm them, they move towards the humble home of the leader. There have been periods during the last decades after Imam Khomeini where this actually happened in Tehran. They moved towards, and they were armed. They moved towards the house of the leader. Sipah put contacted the leaders of that movement, and they told them, look, this is our red line. This street here is our red line. We have our weapons, our machine guns on the roofs. Don't come here. If you cross that, it doesn't matter how many people you bring here. They will not survive. That's our red line. And that's all it took. These are cowards. They turned back. So it looks like what you're calling this is, what is this? This jihad that you just described, it's for following this person. Wilaya of Allah is obeying the Prophet. The Prophet doesn't call to himself. He doesn't say anything himself. When they ask him and they tell him, can you change the Quran? He says, I don't have a right to change anything. These are not my words. That's what you think. This is from God. If He tells me to change any part of it, He told me I'll change any part of it. I am nobody. I am nothing. That's what the Prophet says and really believes. It's only doing what God says. Therefore, if God gave him the wilaya, and God gives that wilaya to a selfless person who doesn't do based on his whims, doesn't decide based on what he wants to do, but decides based on what God has said, what God wants, this becomes obedience of Allah. Therefore, it says, Ati'u Allah wa Ati'u Rasul. And then next, Ulil Amr, by extension, the Imams and whoever they have appointed during the occultation, the Waliul Faqih, okay, Waliul Faqih, who is an Adil Mujtahid, a Mujtahid who is selfless. A mujtahid that comes out when they're attacking him, all these plots against him, comes and says, Ya Allah, I have a disabled body, an incomplete body. And there's a little bit of respect that you have given us, Ya Sahib al-Zaman. All of it is yours. We're standing... and we're willing to give all of it for you. So it would have been a lot, very easy for him, for Imam Khomeini after him, Ayatollah Khomeini, give in. Why do you go against the Zionists? You take care of your own country. Stop going against the Zionists. We'll remove some of the sanctions. No. Stop supplying Hamas and Jihad al-Islami with weapons. We'll remove the sanctions. It's not my choice. God has said we need to do this. Therefore, this is wilayah of Allah. An actual Islamic ruler doesn't call to themselves. They call to Allah. And if they do jihad, it's calling towards ibadah of Allah, not ibadah of themselves. The Umayyad Khulafa They were using jihad to call to themselves. Currently, besides non-Muslims, that's how it is. All every ruler that is not Muslim is clearly saying, "Ana rabbukumul a'la," any ruler. Even the loser ruler of Bahrain really is non-Muslim. I don't know how much they're going to keep this act up. But anyhow, non-Muslim, non-Muslims that are more clear, Western countries, these are pretty much clearly saying that. But amongst the Muslimin, those Muslim rulers, fighting people, calling towards themselves, this is misusing jihad. These organizations that the West calls terrorist organizations that are their own creations, I'm not talking about, they consider Sepah a terrorist organization, Hamas a terrorist organization, Hezbollah a terrorist organization, Ansarullah a terrorist organization. That's who they are. Hashd al-Sha'bi terror, no, these are actually the defenders of humanity, the real mujahidun fi sabilillah. They're calling towards ta'atullah. But no, the ones they created, Al-Qaeda as they used to call it, or Al-Qaeda, the Arabic would be, or Daesh or ISIS, these are their creation. What are they doing? They're calling towards ibadah of ibadullah, not ibadah of Allah. Imam says the first condition is that the purpose of jihad is ad-du'a ila ta'atillah. Don't obey me or anyone. Obey Allah, whatever God says. If I say something, God says something else, a ruler would be saying, the Prophet said this. If I say anything, God says something else, don't listen to me. Listen to what God says. The thing is, God purified the Prophet. He purified the Imams. Whatever they said was from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Then the Imam says, فَمَنْ دُعِيَ إِلَى الْجِزْيَ فَأَبَى قُتِلَ وَسُبِيَ أَهْلُهُ وَلَيْسَ الدُّعَاءُ مِنْ طَاعَةِ. So I did that pause. I should have completed this. My mistake. The flow of the Imam. That point was explained by the Imam in a way. Here it says, the condition is to call towards the ta'a of Allah instead of ta'a of the ibad. But he puts it the other way, meaning that it shouldn't be, jihad should not be used to call towards ibadah of ibadullah. He's going to mention that, as it was used. But before that he says this, and I'm going to have to explain this, but after continuing and getting to the Imam's explanation, this is going to be very important. I'm going to try my best to fit whatever the explanation I can in this session, and then continue it in the next session. فَمَنْ دُعِيَ إِلَى الْجِزْيَةِ. Then whoever... Now, you're supposed to be calling towards Allah, not ibad of Allah. Even in that expansionism of the Umayyad dynasty, that wasn't what the Prophet did. The Prophet did. The territory of Islam expanded during the time of the Prophet. But that expansion and the expansion that happened during the Umayyads are not the same. The ones that happened during the time of what are called Al-Khulafa al-Rashideen, basically up to Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah alayhi's Khilafah, which of course he didn't have that. He was involved with domestic issues. He didn't get involved with expansions. That part is a little different. I don't want to discuss it right now. I don't have enough knowledge. One of the great scholars that has studied this suggests that overall, this doesn't mean every little thing that was done, but overall that was in line with the teachings of the Prophet. And there are signs. Definitely the expansion was going to happen, but the methods used, the tactics, the strategies, when and so on and so forth, that during this period of Khulafa al-Rashidin, even before Amir al-Mu'mineen, the period between the Prophet and Amir al-Mu'mineen, there's a claim that this what happened generally, roughly, not against the Bughat, now that's a different thing, the expansion, we're talking about expansion, was roughly in line with the teachings. And that's for another time. I don't want to discuss that right now. So the expansion during the Umayyads is different. The jihad, we talked about jihad against like Bughat, mainly those were the, that was the example that we, this idea of moving towards non-Muslim areas and expanding. There's a lot to say about that. The Imam mentions something, this is why I'm mentioning this idea. فَمَنْ دُعِيَ إِلَى الْجِزْيَةِ Then whoever is called towards jizya. So first thing, you call towards the ibadah of Allah, not ibadah of the... And then whoever is called towards jizya. Jizya is the tax collected from non-Muslims. There are certain taxes that a Muslim would be paying as a citizen of the Muslim country and the Muslim government in the form of zakat, khums, and perhaps other forms of taxes. A non-Muslim doesn't believe in zakat, therefore they won't be paying zakat. They don't believe in khums, therefore they won't be paying khums. But because they are under that government, and that government has a responsibility to take care of them, and they do, if they're a Muslim government, then they have to contribute financially as well, which is the jizya. So the call towards jizya is really for them to be citizens of the Muslim country, live under the Islamic government, and pay your taxes and enjoy the benefits of the mighty Islamic government. This is calling towards jizya, a non-Muslim entity, roughly. I want to give you a picture of what this is understood as, and then explore the idea more. Whoever is called towards jizya, this would be calling towards jizya. Let's say a non-Muslim city, a non-Muslim region, villages. They're called towards jizya. Join. Then, fa'aba. If they reject it, قُتِلَ وَسُبِيَ أَهْلُ That person will be killed. And سُبِيَ أَهْلُ أَهْلُ is their family, the men that are fighters. They'll be killed. And their families, their daughters, their spouses, their children, سُبِيَ, they will be سَبَايَ, they will be captives, which would then be slaves. Enslave, basically. Enslave their families. I'm going to come back to this, just keep that. I very deliberately explain exactly what those words mean. I'm going to come back to this, all right? This is not the end of this discussion right here. The Imam says, jihad, one of the conditions is calling towards the ibadah of Allah. Then whoever is called towards jizya, if they don't accept, قُتِلَ وَسُبِيَ أَهْلُ Then the person is killed and their family is taken as slaves. That's the rule. So that was what jihad is. What is not jihad is where the Imam starts here. وَلَيْسَ الدُّعَى مِنْ طَاعَةِ عَبْدٍ إِلَى طَاعَةِ عَبْدٍ مِثْلِهِ Jihad isn't to call against the worship or the obedience of this abd of Allah in order for them to worship and obey this abd of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's not what jihad is for. And regarding that second part, وَمَنْ أَقَرَّ بِالْجِزْيَ لَمْ يُتَعَدَّ عَلَيْهِ وَلَمْ تُخْفَرْ ذِمَّتُهُ وَكُلِّفَ دُونَ طَاقَتِهِ And whoever accepts jizya, then you don't violate their right. And the dhimma that they accepted to be part of the, under the Islamic rule, and they receive security with that. That security they receive should not be neglected or betrayed. That trust of theirs can't be betrayed. These are non-Muslims. But if you present it to them, okay, they didn't accept. Or but if they accepted, you mistreat them. And the jizya that is on them, كُلِّفَ دُونَ طَاقَتِهِ They're supposed to be obligated below the limits that they have. In other words, you can't tax them where they have to be giving every drop of their blood to live and survive. No. If they have to push themselves to their limits to make enough to give certain taxes, The Imam says, you shouldn't even push them to their limits. They can do it. You shouldn't even push them to their limits. Less than that. A reasonable amount. The tax has to be something. They live in prosperity. They live in peace. They take care of themselves financially. They have an enjoyable life. Do things that they want. Purchase things that they want. Tax. Something that they can afford without pushing them. Without enslaving them. They're not slaves if they accept jizya. They're not slaves. No, they're free people. They're not Muslims, but they're free people. They're supposed, you can't. Okay. From this point, it changes. And another point is mentioned. It talks about fate. I'm going to stop that there. That we will leave definitely for next week. Our time is up, but because we've discussed this very important thing, I can't cut this off right now. So I apologize. Whoever wants to watch this later and doesn't have time to continue with our session, they can do so. So what is this? First thing that should be said in this regard, this was the first part that we read, فَمَنْ دُعِيَ إِلَى الْجِزْيَةِ Whoever's called towards jizya, if they don't accept it, then they should be killed and they should be, the family should be enslaved. Well, that's where everybody's like, oh my God, what is going on here? All right, let's pause regarding that. What is the Imam trying to say regarding this? A, what is the Imam not trying to say about this? B, and then what can we say about that topic? All right. It sounds like we're saying, all right, the Islamic Empire, this is what Orientalists, as they used to be called, and scholars of Near Eastern studies, and I don't know what they're going to be calling it next. They keep changing the name. It's the same thing. Westerners who were paid to study Muslimin. And not to study them to know the reality of what happened. It's to study them to learn how they can be defeated. That's what the purpose of Western academia is in studying Islam and the Muslimin. So they've said, well, Islam spread with the sword. People were forced into Islam. And they cite verses of the Quran, a hadith like this one, historic, and so on and so forth. I don't want to get into the historic aspect of, you know, who did what, which we accept as Islam, which we don't accept, although it was Muslim, and so on and so forth. I don't want to get into that. We're talking about what Islam says. We're reading what Imam al-Baqir, salamullah alayhi, has written, criticizing the establishment in their use of jihad. So what we said, A, what is the Imam trying to say? When you look at what he's saying, it's clear the Imam's focus is not explaining where. So we went to B first. What is the Imam not saying? The Imam is not trying to explain the details or the rules regarding when jizya applies. He says whenever that applies. He doesn't say use these words. He says whoever is called towards jizya. A question, who's called towards jizya? To assume that any non-Muslim that is a Christian or a Jew or a Zoroastrian, or in other words, follows one of the previous revelations, at any point, wherever, you can just go up to them with a sword and say, you need to pay jizya or do this. That is an assumption that's not founded, that's not being mentioned here, for sure, and it's not what Islam says, okay? The Imam is not trying to explain, all right, what are the rules of when do you tell a person to pay jizya? No, that's not discussed. I'll say that'll be in this order right now, it'll be the last point. We said A, B, and then C. That'll be our C. We're right now explaining B. The Imam is not explaining the rules related to when jizya applies. He's simply, in criticizing the system, this is what the system is doing. We understand that from the words of the Imam. The system is actually betraying those who have accepted jizya. In other words, the Umayyads killed the Christians or Jews or whatever, like what Daesh did. Daesh killed and raped in the name of enslavement, which is completely wrong. These are Ahlul Dhimma. They're not the ones you can approach with this idea. They accepted that. They've been living under the rule of Muslimin for centuries. You can't go to them and fight them and a'yadu billah do what these guys at the time of the Umayyads, what they did. They went over there, now they've joined the Islamic Empire, they are dhimmis, so they should be protected by the government. The government betrays their trust, their males are killed, their women are taken as slaves. The Imam is condemning that. He's saying, if you're at a point where you're presenting jizya, whatever context that is, and if you were doing that right and they rejected at that point, okay, there would be room for why you killed and enslaved. But they've accepted jizya. The criticism is this part. They've accepted jizya. How dare you do that? That's what the Imam is trying. That's A. What is the Imam trying to say? The Imam is critiquing the Umayyad government for betraying the trust of the Christians, the Jews, the Zoroastrians, the Sabians, Sabi'in. And I don't know if there's anything else there that accepted the contract of dhimma, as it is called in fiqh, or they accepted to pay the taxes, jizya, and live under the rule of the Muslimin, pay the taxes, receive the benefits, the services of the government. The government can't betray them. They did. The Imam is condemning the government for that. Okay? So A, that's what the Imam is saying. B, the Imam is not trying to explain, all right, where do you ask a person for jizya? Where do you call them towards jizya? The Imam is not saying that. Okay, last point, C. So what does Islam say in that regard? When is it that a Christian, a Jew, a Zoroastrian, a Sabian is addressed and said, look, you, we're giving you an option here. Well, the other part that is not mentioned, again, the Imam is not going to mention it. Like, you become Muslim. If they become Muslim, then you're just like anyone else. There's no dhimma. Yeah, you have zakat because you're Muslim. You have khums. But you're not considered anything except for a brother or sister. Everybody, they're exactly the same. Up to this point, you were fighting us. At this point, if you become Muslim, just like Abu Sufyan, it's all over. We're brothers. That option is not mentioned. But they don't want to. They want to remain Christian. We don't want to accept your religion. Okay. When is it that you address them and say and present the idea of jizya, pay taxes and be part of the government? Do you just go to any Christian home and say, look, you better do this, otherwise I'm going to kill you. If they reject, you'll kill them and take them as slaves. Well, okay, let's do that. Al-ayyadu billah. That's the Umayyad, that's the Da'ishi view. That's the non-Islamic view. There's a general topic of when fighting is allowed and when fighting is necessary. Then we can come to the topic of jizya. Jizya is in the context of war. Okay. And I want to remind that this is an extremely brief explanation. These topics are not discussed much. A lot of people shy away from them. We believe what Islam says is right, and it's very logical. That doesn't mean everyone's going to agree to it, because not everybody wants to agree to logic. Trump didn't want to agree to logic. Biden doesn't want to. Netanyahu doesn't want to. There's a lot of people that don't want to agree to logic. That doesn't mean that something is not logical. Anyone who wants to use their intellect and understand the logic of it, they can see it. It's very clear. And if there's anything that is really nonsense or doesn't make sense, in other words, what we mean is it's illogical, it's wrong, then it's not from Islam. It has to be do with me or someone else that's misinterpreting Islam deliberately or unintentionally. So because these are not discussed, we haven't discussed it, there's not really another reference point that you can find, but bear in mind what is being said is extremely brief. Just keep these in mind, try to be very careful with what is being said, and think about it, jot it down, perhaps you can ask questions and find references for them. So in the context of war, jizya comes into the picture. Okay. in the context of war with non-Muslims who are people of the book, according to the Quran. There is war between the two nations, and on this side, they're Muslimin. On the other side, they are people of the book, Christian, Jewish, Zoroastrian, Sabian. These are the ones that are mentioned in the Quran. Majus is mentioned in the Quran. Sabi'in is mentioned in the Quran. Nasara are mentioned in the Quran. Al-Yahud are mentioned in the Quran. These are four categories of Ahlul Kitab. If there is war and battle between the two, jizya comes into the play. Now, before explaining where that war can happen, that needs a brief explanation too. Assuming there is war, okay, it already came to a battle. All right, the two sides are lined up and they're about to engage in battle. What happens? The Muslimin are told to pause and tell the Christians or the Jews or the Sabians or Zoroastrians, any member of the people of the book, any people that follow a previous revelation, say, look, before we begin this war, we want to give you an option. The option is that we don't engage in this battle. If we get engaged in battle, we will kick your tails and you will lose a lot of lives. It's war, okay, and we will win. And if we win, those who've died are dead, and those who are alive will be slaves. That's what was mentioned. Subiya ahlu is that those who remain, their relatives, it's not just the women and children, anyone that lives, you'll be slaves. Okay, that's just how it's going to end. But before engaging in this, the option is, let's not do this. All of you can live, and you won't be enslaved. Come into and live under our government, accept this government, pay taxes, and you'll have these liberties, and you have these restrictions. There are these laws. You're accepting this government. Obviously, it comes with laws. There's a package of laws. Otherwise, if you don't, this is what's going to happen. And that's what it means. قُتِلَ وَسُبِيَ أَهْلُهُ shouldn't be understood in this, oh, you go to this individual Christian or Jew. No, it's in the context of battle. And before the battle begins, instead of just saying, okay, these guys are our enemies, they've been fighting, guys, let's go kill these guys, they're all lined up, they want to fight, Islam says, tell them, look, think about this. We don't want to engage in war with you. You are people of the book. The other option is stop this and stop fighting us. Accept to be citizens of our country. We will respect you. You will have these rights. And we pay taxes in the form of zakat and khums. You pay taxes as well. If they agree, then the battle is over. That's what the point of jizya is. That's what. And saying that the ones who don't accept, they will be killed. What is that concept? You just go, everybody's lined up. No, in battle, you engage in war. There are some cases like the case of one of the three tribes of the Jews that ended up losing the males above the age of puberty, meaning even teens lost their lives, which is mentioned in the Quran in Surah Ahzab. That was also war. And that option was given to them. They rejected that. They resorted to another option. Their option led to what the result was. It was their choice that led them to that. It wasn't Islam mandating them to take that choice. But otherwise, besides these exceptions that have... they involve the choice of those others, not something being put on them. Except for those cases, it's a matter of, look, we're about to fight. Let's not do this. Let's work it out in this way. If they don't, yeah, there will be war. If there is a war, then those who are fighting us, they'll get killed. That's just how war is. You know, you don't go to war to start having, I don't know, burgers and flipping burgers. You go to war and you fight each other. The idea of jizya is to avoid that and avoid bloodshed. We are supposed to be suggesting that. If they don't accept, because it's already in the context of battle. This is going to be the last point. What is the context of battle? There's a notion that has been promoted to mean something other than what it is, and a term, jihad ibtidai. Jihad ibtidai means, there are different, I think, equivalents that are used. A better translation or equivalent would be a preemptive strike. I'm not sure if that will be accurate, but it's better than the alternative that has been used. And that is initiating and starting a war or a battle, suggesting that Muslimin are supposed to, and we find this even in Shia fiqh books. Okay, it's not from Islam, but we do find it in Shia fiqh books. I need to say it in that way. My research shows very clearly, and it's not just me, that this is not what Islam says. But unfortunately, at least in some Shia fiqh books, you will find words that seem to mean this. Now, I really don't know, because no Shia scholar has been involved with this jihad. It's just in the books. But that wording in the books is not Islamic. Did they mean it? Did they mean something else? That's what the words mean, but you know, I can't really... I can only say, well, if somebody used these words, wrote them down, then they must have meant them. Okay, they didn't just write words down for the heck of it. If that is the case, then that's a wrong understanding. That's a misunderstanding. The idea that Muslimin are supposed to walk up to neighboring Christian town, neighboring Zoroastrian town, neighboring Jewish town, and say, hey, you're either going to be under our government or you're dead. No, that's not how it works. We're saying, hey, just because you're Jewish, you're Christian, or you're Zoroastrian or Sabian, or just non-Muslim, whatever you are, atheist, agnostic, whatever you want to call yourself, we're going to kill you unless you accept Islam. That's not Islam. That's never been Islam. That's never been the history of Islam. Islam, okay, the history of those who identify as Muslim, other than the Prophet and Imams who've ruled like the Umayyads, like the Abbasids, and like others after them, that's a whole different thing. We're talking about Islam here. No, that's never been Islam. The Prophet never did that. The Prophet was told to be patient when they were killed. The Prophet was told to be patient when they were tortured. That's what happened. They were killed and tortured in Mecca. God told them, be patient, don't fight back right now. They didn't start it. Not only did they not start it, when it was unleashed against them, that violence, they were told to be patient right now. They moved to Medina, their belongings were confiscated, embargoes, trouble, the enmity in so many different ways against them. At this point, God said, you are allowed now to retaliate. The Battle of Badr, as a battle, in some ways, it looks like, and that's one of the instances that are called that it's called jihad ibtidai. Okay, in other words, you strike first. If you understand a war and a battle in the context of the war was not started by the Muslimin. The war was started. We can't really call them battles because it was torture and killing in the city. The people were taken. Those who accepted Islam were taken, killed. And so on and so forth. But those are a form of battle that had already started. The war had started. The killing had started. In the case of the Battle of Badr, the Battle of Badr is not the beginning of the war. And it's not the first strike. The Kuffar have already started the first strike. But even in the context of the Battle of Badr, because the Battle of Badr, the Prophet went to confiscate the belongings of the Kuffar. That was also not some... It looks like, well, they're... striking first, in a sense, well, that's, as in the Palestinian context, it said, you know, you're opening up the book of history on today. Well, that's wrong. You got to flip the pages back a little bit, a few pages back. The Kuffar confiscated, destroyed belongings of the Muslimin. Muslimin had to leave them and go to Medina. After they left, everything was confiscated. The Prophet didn't start that. No. If the Kuffar had not engaged in this war on all these fronts against the Prophet, he wouldn't have done anything. When the Prophet established the government in Medina, did he go to the neighboring tribes who were all pagans and there were Jews and say, hey, you better accept Islam, otherwise you're dead? No. He said, look, you guys want to accept Islam? They said no. So, okay. But we're establishing something here. Everybody here in Medina is wanting this Islamic government. And if you're not going to join it, that's fine. But let's write an agreement between us. We won't hurt you. You guys won't hurt us. We're not going to join your enemies. You guys don't form an alliance or join an alliance against with our enemies against us. It's from basic rules, agreements. These are international treaties. International. These are two different nations. You guys don't want to join this nation by becoming Muslim, or perhaps just there wasn't the idea of jizya wasn't there at that, because again, there's no war at that point. It's just coming here. We're establishing something. The Jews were told, "You want to join?" They said, "No." Okay, you know this is right, but you want to join? Don't join. But here's our relationship with yours. We'll respect you. You respect us back. We won't hurt you. You don't hurt us. We won't join an alliance against you. You don't join an alliance against us. Okay. When they broke that in the context of war, they didn't just say we're going to join that. They joined the enemies. They broke those treaties. That was war. They waged war against the Prophet. Once they waged war, even in that context, two of the tribes, the Prophet told them, look, you did that. We're not going to kill you. Get up and leave. In one case, the crime was not as bad. He told them, take whatever you can take, but you guys are a threat. We can no longer tolerate you guys being here. Leave, take whatever you want, all the gold, silver, whatever you can carry, just carry. Whatever stays, your buildings, your fortresses, whatever you have there, it stays. We can't tolerate you guys living here anymore. You're a threat. You have shown that you don't abide by your words. We can't have you here. You need to leave. Second, when they betrayed and it was worse, so the Prophet told them, you're not allowed to take anything, just leave, take your lives, leave this area, we cannot trust you, the treaty's over. The third one, they engaged in battle, and if it wasn't the strategy of the Prophet, then the Muslimin would have been done for. After the battle was over, the Prophet went over there and told them that you guys need to, we're here to fight you. And they took measures. It's a long story. It ended up that all their males above the age of puberty, they were all killed. And the women and children were taken as captives. Their belongings were taken as well. That was in the context of war. Did the Prophet start the war on them? No. He told them, respect, respect. And the Prophet showed them respect. They did a lot of wrong, okay? The point where this happened is a point where they joined in the Battle of Ahzab, the greatest battle against Muslimin that would have wiped all Muslimin. That's if you understand what that war was, they joined that battle. So everything before that, one side, that battle, that's when it was over. The Prophet said, when the Battle of Ahzab, the southern portion of it with the Mushrikeen was over, the Prophet gathered the companions and said, we got to go towards this tribe, finish this off right now. They went there, camped out of there, out and waited for them. We've got to fight this out. And then the long story of what happened over there in that regard. And the other battles that happened. The Prophet didn't go to his neighbors, the neighboring tribes, pagan, Christian, whatever, even if they weren't people of the book. So you either accept Islam or we're going to kill you. That wasn't the case. They engaged in war. And the war started in other ways first. Theft, bad-mouthing, spreading lies, not allowing Muslimin to have things, embargoes, all those other things. But when it got to threatening the very existence of the Muslimin and their establishment, that's when things would change. That level of war, escalating to that degree of war, is when it was battle time. They came for battle, and when it came to battle time, then for the Christians, it's jizya. You offer this for non-Christians, or in other words, non-Ahlul Dhimma, they don't even have the option. You either become Muslim, or we're going to fight this. The only option given to them is Islam. If you guys accept Islam, become Muslim, and join us, become our brothers, then we're fine. We're not going to engage in this battle. But if you don't, then you're in deep trouble. We're encouraging you not to start this battle. They would start the battle, then obviously they'd get their tails kicked. But who started the wars? They started. War is never started by Muslimin. Has never in history, Islamically, in the Quran, what we have, we're not the ones who start war. We are the ones that when others start war, we are strong to defend. And we will kick their tails. And Allah will grant us victory. And they will be the losers. We don't start war though. Okay. We don't. Other nations want to live as they want. You're fine to do so. We'll even introduce Islam to you. And say, whatever you want to do. You don't want to do it? Don't do it. It's your choice. God is going to treat you in the hereafter. We don't have anything. We're just saying this is what's there. Okay. You want to accept it. You don't want to accept it. We encourage you to accept it. But it's your choice. But if you start fighting, then that's when things are going to change. Because you're fighting us. We're going to defend ourselves. The Palestinians are defending themselves. They didn't start the battle. The Zionists did. The Islamic Republic didn't start going towards their borders and saying, okay, we want this part. This country used to be part of the, I don't know, some Qajar dynasty or this other dynasty. We were all the greater Iran and Persia and... They didn't do any of that. So look, we have these borders. The people within these borders have established this government. We have a responsibility to defend these people. If anybody steps into these borders to transgress as an act of aggression, then they're in deep trouble. But if you don't do that, we are going to be very good neighbors. If there's anything we can help you with, that's what the Islamic, that's what Islam says. Saddam came and fought. The Americans fought. The Americans armed Saddam in Syria, similarly in Lebanon, similarly in Palestine, what we're seeing in Yemen. Those who follow Islam, the axis of Muqawama, they're following Islamic teachings. We're not allowed to start war. People that are not at war, they don't choose to fight us. We say, okay, you guys don't want to agree to our way, we're going to fight you. That's not Islam. It's never been Islam. It's never been in any divine religion. Anyone who claims that that's how it's been, well, whether they know it or not, that's wrong. Go check it. You can find very clearly in the Quran. The battles of the Muslimin started with this verse, أُذِنَ لِلَّذِينَ يُقَاتَلُونَ بِأَنَّهُمْ ظُلِمُوا. We give permission because they have been oppressed, they've been killed, we give permission to fight back. That's the whole context. In Surah Al-Mumtahana, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that generally those who are not fighting against you, لا ينهاكم الله عن الذين لم يقاتلوكم ولم يخرجوكم من دياركم أن تبروهم وتقسطوا إليهم. As individuals and as nations, a people who are not Muslim, they have not fought you. Islam doesn't, not only does Islam not say to fight them, God says, when we said don't form a relationship of wilayah with the kuffar, that doesn't mean don't be nice, and don't do good, and don't treat justly those who haven't fought you. In other words, treat them like that. Anyone who hasn't fought you, any nation that is not Muslim, that has not fought you, be good to them. Treat them justly. But before that, it says, tabarruhum. Bir. Kindness. Show them kindness. If they fight, Be patient. Try to get them not to. If that doesn't work, if they pose a real threat, they're coming for battle, that's not when you say, well, let's see how many they're going to kill. Then we'll think about what we're going to do. No, that's not what happens. If there's any sign of them forming an army to come and fight us before they come, we're going to be intelligent. Before they come, we go equip and we stand there. Like, hey, don't get any ideas. If they still move forward, they come to fight, and we say, okay, look, don't do this. Here's the option. You've taken it this far. If you hadn't done this, then we'd be as we were before. But since you've brought it to this point, we're saying don't fight, but you will have to accept to be citizens. We're not going to let you go back to what it was because you've taken this measure. Okay? You've engaged in battle. You've prepared to kill us. So you can't go back. You either have to accept Islam, become our brothers, or are you going to accept to be citizens of this government and live under this government and we'll provide you security and you'll have your liberties. Okay? But if you want to fight, then yeah, we're up for it and we're not going to shy away from that. But we're encouraging you not to do that. That's in a nutshell, very briefly, what Islam says in regards to battle. So this hadith isn't telling us that you're supposed to address a Kitabi, a Christian, Jew, Zoroastrian, Sabian, and say, oh, you're going to accept to pay jizya, otherwise I'm going to kill you. That's not what this hadith is about. The hadith is about criticizing the Umayyads, where in the case that a Christian or a Jew, the Imam doesn't even say you engage in that battle rightfully. The point is, in whatever way it happened, that Christian accepted jizya. Now you betray that? This is the criticism. This is what the hadith is talking about. And I hope Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala helps us understand these teachings. We can't move forward neglecting this part of Islam, shying away from jihad and battle and the rules of battle. We need to discuss them. If we don't, then they will be able to come and convince our youth that you need to join Daesh. They did. I don't know how many. It's really hard to believe, but it seems like the statistics show that some Muslim youth were convinced that Daesh is working for Allah. You're going to join Islam and you're going to work for Allah. Go by their... Why does that happen? It's because, unfortunately, what Islam actually says has never been mentioned. Read Surah Mumtahana, realize based on that, there is no such thing as attacking, oh, we're going to take over these lands and we're going to form Khilafah, we're going to take everybody as slaves and this, that, the other. That's not what Islam says. That's what Mossad wants you to say in the form of Islam. That's what the CIA wants you to say in the form of Islam. As a Muslim with a big beard and La ilaha illallah and Muhammad Rasulullah, that's what they want you to say. That's not what the Quran says. Go read what the Quran says. Don't only look at Salah and Saum, and then some idiot comes, CIA agent, Mossad agent, FBI agent, comes and tricks you into thinking that there's some sheikh, some this, some that, and pretends that they're preaching you Islam and tells you, oh, let me teach you, look at this hadith. Look at this hadith on jihad. Oh, you need to go do jihad. What's jihad? Go join Daesh. The reason why some youth were misled is because the correct understanding of jihad in qital has not been explained. And that leaves room for abalis and shayateen, devils, to misinterpret and present what is, as the Imam says, that's the whole hadith. The hadith is criticizing those who in the name of Islam are using jihad to go against Islamic jihad, to go against the Islamic teachings. We hope that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala helps us move in the direction that our imams would be pleased with us. Walhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen.